There are looks, but there's no looks. Can we get some light down here? Just a little? Good. Well, welcome to you all, you heroic people who turned out tonight on, the most disagreeable evening I can remember in Chicago. I guess it's going to get worse, but at any rate, we're inside for the time being. I'm John Van Doren, by the way, for the Poetry Center. Our next reading is on February 8th. We don't try to make you come out in January. And that will be a reading by Alain Rawlings and Ted Kooser, a double reading. Ted Kooser's been here before. I don't think Alain has been here before. But in any case, they are very different poets, both wonderful. And I know you'll enjoy it. I have also to tell you, I've been asked to tell you by Andrew Patner, that the circular that you see around, and I guess which you may have been given, from an organization called Democratic Vistas towards a new American arts policy, and which is sponsoring a gathering at Columbia College on January 9th, of which the title is Making Art and Building Communities, Reflections on the Poetic Economy, a meeting at which Robert Haas and Tulani Davis will both appear. We would be happy if you found it possible to get to that. I beg your pardon. It's at the Harold Washington Library Center at the Chicago Public Library, not at Columbia College. The lower level at the auditorium. Tonight's reading by Liesl Mueller is underwritten in part by the Lannan Foundation, the Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs, the Illinois Arts Council, and Poets and Writers Incorporated through a grant it has received from the Lannan Foundation. And now to introduce Liesl Mueller, I will introduce Paulette Reske, herself a wonderful poet and a member of our board. Paulette?
Okay. I think you've already been applauded for braving the elements. Quite unfairly, it seems to me, it is most difficult to remark about those one most admires, rather like trying to write a poem having just arrived in the benign yellow light of your own front porch, flushed and breathless from whatever narrow escape or exhilaration it was your unhappy fate or good fortune to sustain. At least this is my dilemma when I attempt to translate my regard for poet Liesl Mueller into these sentences, since it is she who has been mentor, she who has mothered my words for more than a decade. Over the past 30 years, her work has met with wide acclaim, for among her collections are The Private Life, the Lamont Selection for 1975, The Need to Hold Still, winner of the National Book Award for 1981, and Waving from Shore, recipient of the 1990 Carl Sandburg Award. Beyond her books of poems, she has also translated extensively from the German, short stories and poetry by Marie-Louise Kosnitch, including the selected later poems, and a novel, Three Daughters, by Anna Mitgutsch. Her essays and selected poems from Dependencies, her first collection, were published in 1990 as Learning to Play by Ear. In the title essay, Mueller comments on her experiences as a mother and as a poet, concluding the two roles intersect at the juncture of growth, transformation, and possibility, themes which are variously rendered in her books as changes which give us the future, as she says in Large Jigsaw Puzzle. These are also the concerns of the myths and folktales to which she refers as the treasure mountain of metaphor I plunder for my poems, and indeed both put clarity in the service of mystery, for hers is, above all, a lucid poetry that admits us to a world that is at once familiar and magical. When her new and selected poems appears next year, this will bring the number of her collections to 6, each representing, as she has said, not only a stage in her personal life, but also a stage in history. Because she left Germany under Duras in 1939, the pull between the personal and the historical reflects her experience. In Europe, no one has had a private life not affected by history, she has remarked, and in Virtuosi, she describes the courage of those immigrants whose lives collide with a history that is always tragic, but they do not want to talk about it, would rather dance, give parties on thrift shop china. If she does not indulge suffering, neither does she deny it, ready always, as in her poem Joy, where joy is blindingly sad, to recognize one emotion attends the other in those moments worth recording, each modulating its opposite in the highest range of response, which I think of as a place inhabited by the human spirit. And it is for the sake of such moments, after all, that we pick up the pen to write. We open the book and begin to read. It gives me particular pleasure to present, on behalf of the Poetry Center of Chicago, Liesl Mueller.
Thank you, Paulette, very much. And thank you all extremely much for coming out on this absolutely terrible night. I can't imagine a worse one, so I feel very honored. When I decided what to read tonight, I didn't know the weather was going to be like this, obviously, but I chose a poem about our climate, so I think I must have known what I was doing. This is called Letter to California. I think that climate not only affects lifestyle, I think it even affects language itself. People in California talk differently from the way we talk here. Letter to California. We write to each other as if we were using the same language, though we are not. Your sentences lap over each other like the waves of the Pacific, strictureless. Your long, sleek, voweled words fill my mouth like ripe avocados. To read you is to dismiss news of earthquakes and mudslides, to imagine time in slow motion. It is to think of the sun as a creature that will not let anything happen to you. Back here, we grow leeks and beans and sturdy roots that will keep for months. We have few disasters, i.e. no grandeur to speak of. Instead, we engage in a low-keyed, continuous struggle to get through the winter, which swallows two seasons and throws its shadow over a third. How do you manage without snow to tell you that you are mortal? We are brought up short by a wind that shapes our words. They fall in clean, blunt strokes. The birds here are mostly chickadees and juncos, monochromes bred to the long view, like the sky under siege of lead, and the bony trees which hold the dancer's first position month after month. But we have our intimations. Now and then, a cardinal with its lyric call, its body blazing like a saint's unexpectedly gaudy heart, spills on our reasonable scene of brown and white, unconscious of itself. I search the language for a word to tell you how red is red. And another poem about this part of the country, the Midwest. This is actually a series of poems, a collection of poems, six short poems, which I put together under the title Highway Poems. They come out of vacations that we used to take with our daughters, Lucy and Jenny, in the Midwest, mostly Wisconsin and Michigan. We did a lot of driving around, and we did a lot of camping. And those were wonderful years, but there was also the sad realization for all of us of so many towns, little towns that had once been flourishing, that were deserted and were dying because the interstate system, which then was pretty new, had passed them by. Highway Poems. One, the narrow black veins on the map will get you there, but the fat red arteries get you there quicker and without pain. You can go from the head to the toes of America without ever seeing a hospital or a jail, without ever coming on tears, toys, wrinkles, scars, fists, guns, crossed fingers, broken teeth. Two. Between the roof of the Howard Johnson and the star of the Holiday Inn falls the shadow, which is myself. Question, am I real when I exist only inside a hot steel body at 70 miles per hour, and when I'm freed, become a certain car door slam, a brief pattern of footsteps outside a numbered door? Three, hardly anyone takes the old state road anymore. The town is dying, its blood being pumped into the new expressway 5 miles east of here. Sad and miraculous now, transfigured by extinction, are the ones who stay to go down with the town. The proprietor of the general store and the Restwell cabins, vacancy always, and the postmistress, his wife, angel of government checks and news from a world with receding walls. Four, camping, you learn people by their shoes in the toilet stalls. The brown loafers support white legs and a silver trailer. The navy tennis shoes go with Pepsodent and a black wig. The tiny saddle shoes match a voice which talks about being three. And I must be a pair of yellow sneakers, blue patched at the toes. Although, being filled with my life, I don't believe it. And the fifth section is about place names in the Midwest, many of which are commemorative of old places in Europe and the Middle East. and others are wildly inventive. Austrian food is not served in Vienna, and people in Paris drink Coke, not wine. Lebanon has its little league, and Warsaw its Civil War cannon. Carthage is full of blondes, and Cairo divides American style into white and black, money and rage. Gnawbone keeps teasing, a tricky riddle, and what cheer defies punctuation. But stony lonesome is all that it says. I have seen Hindustan, Hoosier twang, no belly dancing allowed. And I have been in Arcadia, one street by a railroad track, blue chicory, goldenrod. O telltale country, fact and mirage, coat of many colors, stitched in homesickness, threaded with dreams, land of the seven fat cows. Is it finished, your poem? And the sixth and last section takes off from some lines by Wallace Stevens. We keep coming back to the real, to the hotel, instead of the hymns that fall upon it out of the wind. We keep coming back to the old hotel on the old main street in the old part of town, to the tottering giant, the elephant sagging on concrete feet. We keep coming back to the white railed porch, the geraniums and the wicker chairs, the glass doors and the Persian carpet, the banquet hall with chandeliers, where the Chamber of Commerce meets and talks about pride and achievement, while the stores on the block are vacant, their windows blind, their clerks gone to the big new mall outside of town, where the chain stores are, with checkout lanes and shopping carts, where shoplifting is a crime. We keep coming back to the corpses of elms, umbrellas of shade, umbrellas of peace, imagining grandparents, newspapers, cups, people out walking, the ticket booth of the movie theater occupied. Were things really better when the hotel served the best Sunday dinner around, and the bridal suite was booked solid? When the governor campaigned on the steps, promising dollars for votes? We keep coming back to what we gave up. Remember, we never wanted to live here in the days of parades and the fireman's ball and the high school musical once a year. No, these are deathbed visits, regrets, surprising grief and sudden love, terror of loss, the need to lay hands on the past before it is gone. Hold on to the knowledge, at least, if not the stairs and walls of our history. Walk away grieving, at least, assured that sometime, a long time ago, we came from somewhere, that we are real. We're a nation of mythmakers and visionaries. Our whole history is founded on that. And I'm sure we're not unique in this respect, that each country has its own particular myth. Ours is so bound up with the notion of the West, of the frontier, the romance of the West, and with visions of freedom and innocence. So I made up a little myth for us. The Lonesome Dream. In the America of the dream, the first rise of the moon swings free of the ocean, and she reigns in her shining flesh over a good great valley of plumed, untrampled grasses and beasts with solemn eyes, of lovers infallibly pitched in their ascendant phase. In this America, death is virginal also, roaming the good great valley in his huge boots, his shadow steady and lean, his pistol silver, his greeting clear and courteous as a stranger's who looks for another, a mind to share his peaceable evenings. Dreaming we are another race than the one that fires wild than the one which wakes in the cold sweat of fear, fires wild shots at death, builds slippery towers of glass to head him off, waylays him with alcohol traps, rides him down in canyons of sex, and hides in teetering ghost towns. Dreaming, we are the mad who swear by the blood of trees and speak with the tongues of streams through props of steel and sawdust. A colony of souls ravaged by visions, bound to some wild secret cove not yet possessed, a place still innocent of us. Now I'm going to read some personal poems which come out of childhood memories. When Sleeping Beauty was struck by that 100-year spell of sleep, not only was she struck instantly, but so was everyone in the castle. And I had a book as a child, a Sleeping Beauty book, which had a large picture of the people in the kitchen being struck by sleep, mid-gesture, because the spell came so suddenly that it was like children playing statues, you know, when they freeze in the middle of an action. And I loved this picture. It must have impressed itself on me because 2 years ago I wrote a poem about it. And I'm imagining the continuation of the actions that were interrupted when the spell struck. Immortality. In Sleeping Beauty's castle, the clock strikes 100 years, and the girl in the tower returns to the world. So do the servants in the kitchen who don't even rub their eyes. The cook's right hand lifted an exact century ago completes its downward arc to the kitchen boy's left ear. The boy's tensed vocal cords finally let go the trapped, enduring whimper. And the fly, arrested midway above the strawberry pie, fulfills its abiding mission and dives into the sweet red glaze. As a child, I had a book with a picture of that scene. I was too young to notice how fear persists and how the anger that causes fear persists, that its trajectory can't be changed or broken, only interrupted. My attention was on the fly, that this slight body, with its transparent wings and lifespan of one human day, still craved its particular share of sweetness a century later. And this childhood memory comes from seeing my first opera, Cavalleria Rusticana, at the age of 11. I saw it in Verona, Italy, in an outdoor amphitheater that had been built by the Romans. And what impressed me about this event more than the opera itself was a custom that the Italians had, and I understand still have, that in this outdoor arena, when the conductor comes onto the podium, they light long matches or birthday candles, and everyone becomes very silent. And it is completely silent by the time the matches have burned out. And then the conductor raises his baton. Cavalleria Rusticana. All the fireflies in the world are gathered in my yard tonight, flickering in the shrubs like an ostentatious display of Christmas lights out of season. But the music in the air is the music of heat, of August, cicadas scraping out their thin, harsh treble, like country fiddlers settling in for a long night. I feel at home with their relentless tune, minimalist, like the 80s. Events repeat themselves, but with a difference that makes all the difference. As a child, one summer night in Verona, at my first opera, I watched a swarm of matches light up the Roman arena until we were silent. It was as if music were a night-blooming flower that could not open until we held our breath. Then the full-blown sound of single-minded combat of passions, voices sharpening their glittering blades on one another, electing to live or die. It was that simple. The story was of no importance, the motive lost in the sufficient breathing dark. If there was a moon, I don't remember. And this one is about music also, except the musician mentioned here is a jazz musician, Charlie Parker. And after he died in the 60s, I used to see graffiti on walls and underpasses that said, "Bird Lives." As you know, Bird was his nickname. Missing the dead. I miss the old scrawl on the viaduct, the crazily dancing red letters, "Bird Lives." It's gone now, the wall as clean as forgetting. I go home and put on a record, Charlie Parker live at the Blue Note. Each time I play it, months or years apart, the music emerges more luminous. I never listened so well before. I wish my parents had been musicians and left me themselves transformed into sound, or that I could believe in the stars as the radiant bodies of the dead. Then I could stand in the dark, pointing out my mother and father to all who did not know them, how they shimmer, how they keep getting brighter as we keep moving toward each other. I think I'll have a drink of water. And this is a poem about aging, poem for my birthday. I have stopped being the heroine of my bad dreams. The melodramas of betrayal and narrow escapes from which I wake up grateful for an unexciting life are starring my troubled young friend or one of my daughters. I'm not the one who swims too far out to sea. I am the one who waves from shore vainly and in despair. Life is what happens to someone else. I stand on the sidelines of my life. I'm still afraid in my dreams, but not for myself. Fear gets rededicated with a new stone that bears a needier name. I'll read a couple of fantasy poems. All night. All night, the knot in the shoelace waits for its liberation. And the match on the table pecks its head with anticipation of light. The faucet sweats out a bead of water which gathers strength for the free fall, while the lettuce in the refrigerator succumbs to its brown killer. And in the novel I put down before I fall asleep, the paneled walls of a room are condemned to stand and wait for tomorrow, when I'll get to the page where the prisoner finds the secret door and steps into air and the scent of lilacs. This one is not about things like that. Inanimate things. This one is about a mermaid. The idea of a mermaid. A mermaid to me is a figuration of something that is tremendously elusive and immensely ephemeral and beautiful and therefore extremely precious. The mermaid. All night, he had felt her stirring under his boat, and several times when the net had tightened, frog nervous, he had bungled the pulling in, half glad of the stupid open mouths he could throw back. At sundown, the holding and shifting of time and air had brought her to the still surface where lilies and leeches tangled and rocked. He could have taken her then, aimed his net as dragonfly hunters do when the glassy gliding of rainbows goes to their heads. Could have taken her home on tiptoe and lifted her lightly, ever so lightly, over his sill. And hopeless knew that to have her alive was only this, the sounding, casting, waiting, seeing, and willing the light not to move, not yet to round the bay of her shoulder, and passing, release her to the darkness he would not enter. This is a series of tiny poems called Imaginary Pictures. Imaginary paintings, rather. How I would paint the future. A strip of horizon and a figure in silhouette. forever approaching. How I would paint happiness. Something sudden, a windfall, a meteor shower. No, a flowering tree, releasing all its blossoms at once, and the one standing beneath it, unexpectedly robed in bloom, transformed into a stranger too beautiful to touch. 3. How I would paint death. White on white, or black on black. No ground, no figure. An immense canvas, which I will never finish. How I would paint love. I would not paint love. How I would paint the leap of faith. A black cat jumping up 3 feet to reach a 3-inch shelf. How I would paint the big lie. Smooth and deceptively small, so that it can be swallowed like something we take for a cold. An elongated capsule, an elegant cylinder, sweet and glossy, that pleases the tongue and goes down easy. Never mind the poison inside. And the last is how I would paint nostalgia. An old-fashioned painting, a genre piece. People in bright and dark clothing. A radiant bride in white, standing above a waterfall, watching the water rush away, away, away. And now, for some real paintings, appropriately, about Monet. I'm sure everyone here has seen the wonderful exhibition that just closed. And the poem is called Monet Refuses the Operation. The operation in question being removal of cataracts, which he was urged to have in 1912 and refused to have. I imagine that he was probably afraid of going blind, because that was not an easy operation, a very uncertain operation in those days. But I'm giving him a different reason for refusing. Monet refuses the operation. Doctor, you say there are no halos around the streetlights in Paris, and what I see is an aberration caused by old age, an affliction. I tell you, it has taken me all my life to arrive at the vision of gas lamps as angels, to soften and blur and finally banish the edges you regret I don't see, to learn that the line I called the horizon does not exist, and sky and water so long apart are the same state of being. 54 years before I could see Rouen Cathedral is built of parallel shafts of sun, and now you want to restore my youthful errors, fixed notions of top and bottom, the illusion of three-dimensional space, wisteria separate from the bridge it covers. What can I say to convince you the Houses of Parliament dissolve night after night to become the fluid dream of the Thames? I will not return to a universe of objects that don't know each other, as if islands were not the lost children of one great continent. The world is flux, and light becomes what it touches, becomes water, lilies on water, above and below water, becomes lilac and mauve and yellow and white and cerulean lamps, small fists passing sunlight so quickly to one another that it would take long streaming hair inside my brush to catch it, to paint the speed of light. Our weighted shapes, these verticals, burn to mix with air and change our bones, skin, clothes to gases. Doctor, if only you could see how heaven pulls earth into its arms and how infinitely the heart expands to claim this world, blue vapor without end. This is a little poem, a love poem. I think perhaps many of you have had the experience that I had this time traveling with my husband in spring from here to into the south, and how you follow the spring, how the spring deepens actually into summer as you travel. And then, of course, going in the opposite direction, you have the reverse. It gets colder and colder again, and you revert to the beginning of spring or to winter. Fiction. Going south, we watched spring unroll like a proper novel. Forsythia, dogwood, rose, bare trees, green lace, full shade. By the time we arrived in Georgia, the complications were deep. When we drove back, we read from back to front. Maroon went wild, went scarlet, burned once more, and then withdrew into pink, tentative, still in bud. I thought, if only we could go on and meet again, shy as strangers. I think that in recent years we've all come to the point of wondering what's going to happen if the world is completely coming apart, and what the prospects of survival are. And so I was thinking about that and pulled out a poem I wrote some years back, which I think is essentially optimistic. What will you do? What did you do when the glacier paved your mouth with ice? When your scales fell off and were left on the ground to rust? When you stopped treading water and started breathing air? What did you do when you realized you were different from the others? When you were cheated of your fur, your prehensile tail? When death revealed itself as the supreme being, unappeasable? And what did you do when the sun stopped revolving around you, when animals started to disappear, and the trees loosened their roots imperceptibly at first so you would not notice, when water declared an eye for an eye and pumped your poison back into you? And when your children left you and joined the enemy, when the air became colder and colder and you moved faster than air, though your love letter never got there? What did you do when history fell down at your feet and asked to start all over? That's what you will do. And I want to follow that with a poem of great joy about being alive. and being the miracle that I am, that any of us are, the particular combination of genes and circumstance that we turned out to be. There are a couple of references here that might, I do a lot of name dropping here, that might, I might explain. There's a reference to an astronomer with a golden nose, and I had read somewhere that the medieval astronomer Tycho Brahe had a prosthetic nose made out of gold. And also, we've often been told that George Washington wore dentures and that they were made of wood. I think that's an apocryphal story, but I put it in. Anyway. Alive together. Speaking of marvels, I am alive together with you when I might have been alive with anyone under the sun, when I might have been Abelard's woman or the whore of a Renaissance pope or a peasant wife with not enough food and not enough love, with my children dead of the plague. I might have slept in an alcove next to the man with the golden nose who poked it into the business of stars, or sewn a starry flag for a general with wooden teeth. I might have been the exemplary Pocahontas, or a woman without a name weeping in master's bed, for my husband exchanged for a mule, my daughters lost in a drunken bet. I might have been stretched on a totem pole to appease a vindictive god, or left a useless girl child to die on a cliff. I like to think I might have been Mary Shelley, in love with a wrong-headed angel, or Mary's friend. I might have been you. This poem is endless. The odds against us are endless. Our chances of being alive together, statistically non-existent. Still, we have made it, alive in a time when rationalists in square hats and hatless Jehovah's Witnesses agree it is almost over. Alive with our lively children, who but for endless ifs might have missed out on being alive, together with marvels and follies, and longings and lies and wishes, and error and humor and mercy, and journeys and voices and faces, and colors and summers and mornings, and knowledge and tears and chance. And I'm going to close as I started with a weather poem. This one's called Not Only the Eskimos. I have two obsessions. Well, I have more than two, but two that are obsessions that keep coming up in my poetry are language and snow. And in this poem, I can get them both together. This is to show that we have just as much snow, or as many different ways of expressing what snow is, just as many as the Eskimos. We have only one noun, but as many different kinds. The grainy snow of the Puritans and snow of soft, fat flakes. Gorilla snow, which comes in the night and changes the world by morning. Rabbinical snow, a permanent skullcap on the highest mountains. Snow that blows in like the Lone Ranger riding hard from out of the west. Surreal snow in the Dakotas, when you can't find your house, your street, though you are not in a dream or a science fiction movie. Snow that tastes good to the sun when it licks black tree limbs, leaving us only one white stripe, a replica of a skunk. Unbelievable snows, the blizzard that strikes on the 10th of April, the fall snow before Indian summer, the big snow on Mozart's birthday when Chicago became the Elysian Fields and strangers spoke to each other. Paper snow, cut and taped to the inside of grade school windows. In an old tale, the snow that covers a nest of strawberries, small hearts, ripe and sweet. The special snow that goes with Christmas, whether it falls or not. The Russian snow we remember, along with the warmth and smell of our furs, though we have never traveled to Russia or worn furs. Villon's snows of yesteryear, lost with ladies gone out like matches. The snow in Joyce's The Dead, the silent, secret snow in a story by Conrad Aiken, which is the snow of first love. The snowfall between the child and the space woman on TV. Snow as idea of whiteness, as in snowdrop, snow goose, snowball bush. The snow that puts stars in your hair, and your hair, which has turned to snow. The snow Eleanor Wiley walked in velvet shoes. The snow before her footprints, and the snow after. The snow in the back of our heads, whiter than white, which has to do with childhood again, each year. Thank you very much.
Liesl has very kindly agreed to take questions at this time, so if there are questions you would like to pose, please feel free to do that now. Also, on your way out, her books are available for sale at the table where you entered, and she will be happy to sign those for you after the reading. So if you would come down to the front with them, you can get a signature.
Again, I thank you very much for coming out on this horrible night. Are there any questions? Paulette, would you be able to just point out, since I can't see well enough to see who has a hand raised, which book is the last poem in? It's in The Need to Hold Still. Well, my first collection came out when I was already past 40. However, I actually started writing seriously. I had written in college and then had stopped for a long time, but I really started writing seriously when I was 29, and quite late. And it was brought about, my urge to write poetry, by my mother's death. I think it was the emotional catalyst which got me started writing poems and then continuing to write. In fact, I've written a poem about that, and it's very short. Let me see if I can say it from memory. It's called When I Am Asked. When I am asked how I began writing poems, I talk about the indifference of nature. It was soon after my mother died, a brilliant June day, everything blooming. I sat in a lovingly planted garden I sat on a gray stone bench in a lovingly planted garden, but the daylilies were as deaf as the ears of drunken sleepers, and the roses curved inward. Nothing was black or broken, and not a leaf fell, and the sun kept blaring endless commercials for summer holidays. I sat on a gray stone bench ringed with the ingenue faces of pink and white impatience, and placed my grief in the mouth of language, the only thing that would grieve with me. Yes, I didn't do any research on it. It was just, the images just came to me. I tried to come up with 26 different ones because I'd been told that the Eskimos had 26 different words of snow for snow. And I just, you know, just freely associated. And then I arranged them in what seemed to be the best order. You may have noticed the poem goes from the very concrete to the abstract. Yes. No, I don't have any. I can only write when the spirit moves me. I haven't been outside for the last 2 hours, so I can duck that question. Yes. Yes, I've never written in any other language. I always say that even though German was my first language, English was my first language for poetry. No, I don't. I'm sorry. I used to teach, but I don't anymore. Okay, is that it? One more question? Yes. The Monet, yes, that's called Monet Refuses the Operation. That is in the book Second Language. Okay, thanks again.